Welcome to the deep dive. You send in a fascinating case, one that really cuts to the quick of some, challenging legal territory.
Definitely.
We're going to unpack Commonwealth v. Loewen, a Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decision from 1989. Think of this as your streamlined guide to a crucial moment where questions of police conduct clashed, really clashed, with the need to prosecute a serious crime.
Right.
Our mission here is to pull out the key insights relevant to you as future legal professionals.
That's right. Commonwealth v. Loewen is it's a prime example for law students to wrestle with. At its heart is this fundamental conflict. What happens when law enforcement officers step outside the bounds of the law? And how does that affect the legitimacy of a criminal trial, especially in a murder case?
Mm.
This forces us to consider the delicate balance between ensuring accountability for potential police wrongdoing and the imperative to see justice done in serious criminal matters.
Okay, let's paint the picture then. It's 1988 in Dorchester, Boston. A police officer, Detective Sherman C. Griffiths, was tragically killed during a drug investigation at an apartment building on Bellevue Street. So, a really high stakes and deeply unfortunate situation right from the get-go.
Indeed. A very intense situation. And into this environment steps Albert Loewen, the defendant. He faced very serious charges, including murder, armed assault, weapons offenses, all tied to the death of Officer Griffiths.
Okay.
It's also noted in the standard brief that Mr. Loewen was a Black Jamaican male, a detail that, while maybe not the focus of our legal analysis today, can sometimes, influence the broader context of cases like these.
Right. Context matters. Now, here's where the investigation takes a seriously problematic turn. It wasn't exactly textbook procedure, was it?
No, not at all. In fact, it was marred by significant misconduct, specifically involving Detective Robert Luna. He was instrumental in obtaining the search warrant for the apartment where the shooting actually occurred.
Okay, so Luna's key here.
Precisely. And here's where it gets really, really troubling. Detective Luna actually admitted to outright lying in the sworn affidavit he submitted to get that search warrant.
He admitted it. Wow.
Yes. He claimed to have personally witnessed drug activity at the apartment, and he even fabricated an informant, a completely made-up individual he named John, just to strengthen his request and, persuade the judge to authorize the search.
So just to be crystal clear, this wasn't like a simple error or a misinterpretation. This was a deliberate act of deception, a lie told under oath to justify a search.
Exactly.
That strikes at the very foundation of our protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, doesn't it? I mean, that's a cornerstone.
Absolutely. The Fourth Amendment is designed to prevent precisely this kind of overreach by the government. By fabricating information to get the warrant, Detective Luna directly undermined that fundamental safeguard. It really calls into question the entire legal basis for the search that then led to everything that happened inside the apartment.
Yeah, the whole chain of events.
But the issues, they don't actually end there, do they?
No, because the story of this supposed informant, this John, adds another layer of, ethical and legal complexity. The defense argued that John, whether he was real or just imagined, possessed information that could potentially exonerate Loewen.
Right.
Their theory was that John could have shown that Loewen wasn't actually running a drug operation out of that apartment, which was, a key element of the prosecution's case. So why was this John character so significant?
Well, what's particularly noteworthy is how the prosecution initially handled the whole matter of John.
Mm-hmm.
Despite explicit court orders to reveal John's identity and produce him as a witness, they just failed to do so.
They didn't comply with court orders.
No. And this naturally raised serious questions about what the prosecution knew, when they knew it, and frankly, whether they were actively hindering the defense's ability to investigate and build their case. This also brings the Brady Rule squarely into play, which, as you know, mandates the prosecution has to disclose exculpatory evidence, stuff that could help the defense.
Mm, right, the Brady obligation. So this all culminated in the lower court, the Superior Court, taking a pretty extraordinary step, didn't they? They actually dismissed the indictments against Loewen. That's not something you see every day.
No, definitely not. Dismissal of indictments is considered a very significant and unusual remedy. The Superior Court judge clearly concluded that the police misconduct, specifically the fabrication of the search warrant and then the failure to produce John, was just so severe.
Egregious, really.
Exactly. Sad. Egregious. And had so significantly impaired Loewen's ability to mount a defense that dismissal of the charges was the only way to ensure fairness. The judge essentially determined that the damage to Loewen's defense was, irreparable at that stage.
Irreparable harm. Okay. But that wasn't the final word, because the Supreme Judicial Court, the SJC, then intervened and reinstated the indictments. What was the SJC's reasoning for overturning the lower court's pretty drastic decision? What's the key insight into their thinking here?
Well, the SJC, in its majority opinion, made it really clear that dismissing criminal charges is truly a last resort.
A last resort. Yeah.
While they acknowledged the, quote, reprehensible nature of the police misconduct, they didn't sugarcoat that they ultimately reasoned that it didn't necessarily prevent Lewin from receiving a fair trial. Their decision rested on the idea that there were other legal mechanisms available to address the misconduct without resorting to dismissal.
Okay, let's delve deeper into those legal mechanisms. What specific legal principles were really at the forefront of this SJC decision? We've mentioned Brady v. Maryland. Can you just remind us of its core principles specifically in the context of this case?
Certainly. Brady v. Maryland is fundamental to fair criminal procedure. In essence, it requires the prosecution to disclose any evidence in its possession that could be favorable to the defendant. That means evidence that might suggest the defendant's innocence or otherwise benefit their defense. The situation with the informant John clearly falls under this obligation, right? Because the defense argued he possessed potentially exculpatory information.
Makes sense.
So the Brady rule is there to ensure sort of a level playing field in terms of access to relevant information.
Okay. So the prosecution's initial failure regarding John raised potential Brady issues, but the SJC didn't see that as automatically warranting dismissal. So what was the central legal question the SJC was really grappling with concerning the appropriate remedy for this kind of government misconduct?
Yeah, the critical question before the SJC was, under what circumstances does government misconduct, whether it's by the police or the prosecution, justify the extreme step of dismissing criminal charges? The courts have to weigh several factors, including the degree to which the misconduct actually prejudiced the defendant's right to a fair trial, and also the seriousness, and importantly, the deliberateness of the misconduct itself.
So intentionality matters.
It does. It's a really delicate balancing act between protecting individual rights and serving the public interest in prosecuting crime.
Okay, let's dissect the SJC's majority reasoning, primarily articulated by Justice Wilkins. What were the key arguments they presented for reinstating the indictments despite the acknowledged police lies? What's the core of their rationale?
Well, the majority argued that even with Detective Lina's, deplorable actions, Lewin still had legal avenues to challenge the evidence against him during the trial.
Okay, like what?
They specifically pointed to the defense's ability to rigorously cross-examine the officers who lied, thereby exposing their fabrications to the jury. They also suggested that the trial judge could issue specific jury instructions to address the credibility of the police witnesses and the circumstances surrounding how that search warrant was obtained.
So use the trial process itself.
Exactly. The majority famously stated, and this is a key quote, that society need not punish itself by dismissing charges unless there's clear proof that the misconduct actually undermined the defense's ability to have a fair trial. Prejudice is key. So the key insight here is the court prioritized the possibility of a fair trial, even with these dirty hands in the investigation, believing other mechanisms could address the misconduct.
That's a really powerful statement, highlighting that tension we discussed earlier. But there were dissenting opinions within the SJC, weren't there? Chief Justice Liakos and Justice Abrams disagreed pretty strongly with the majority's conclusion. What were their central counterarguments?
Absolutely. The dissenting justices felt very strongly that the majority was, frankly, underestimating the gravity and the consequences of the police misconduct. Chief Justice Liakos didn't hold back at all, describing the misconduct as, quote, contemptible and disgusting.
Strong words.
Very strong. His argument was that the intentional lies and the obstruction had so fundamentally tainted the integrity of the entire judicial process that dismissal was the only appropriate response to deter such behavior in the future. For him, it was about upholding the core principles of justice, even if it meant potentially not prosecuting a serious crime. This perspective really emphasizes the need to safeguard the system itself from abuse.
Protecting the integrity of the process. And Justice Abrams echoed those concerns too, right? Placing particular emphasis on the prejudice suffered by Lewin and his ability to mount a proper defense.
Yes, exactly. Justice Abrams was deeply concerned that the lies and the perjury had irreparably damaged Lewin's chances of presenting a credible defense. She argued that reinstating the indictments would essentially signal that such egregious misconduct would be tolerated, potentially encouraging similar actions by law enforcement down the line.
Sending the wrong message.
Precisely. In her view, the very foundation for a fair trial had been so compromised that it simply couldn't be salvaged. She even raised the possibility that John was entirely a fabrication, which would further prejudice Lewin's situation. This really highlights the potential long-term damage to the fairness of the system when such misconduct occurs.
Now, here's a fascinating twist, almost unexpected given everything we've discussed. Despite all the misconduct and the intense legal battle that went all the way up to the SJC, Albert Lewin was ultimately acquitted at trial. What can we infer from that outcome, if anything?
That's a really crucial point to consider. Lewin's acquittal, despite the tainted search warrant and all the issues surrounding the informant John, suggests that the justice system, at least in this particular instance, was able to function at the trial level.
The jury got it right, perhaps?
Well, the jury, presumably after hearing all the evidence, including the impeachment of the officers and the arguments, was not convinced of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, even with evidence that had been initially obtained under, let's say, highly questionable circumstances. It could speak to the effectiveness of cross-examination in revealing inconsistencies, and maybe the jury's critical role in assessing witness credibility.
But there's another side to it.
There is. As some analyses of the case have pointed out, the fact that the police officer's death went unavenged could, in a very real sense, be attributed to the police's own misconduct.
Wow.
It's a sobering thought about the potential, you know, unintended consequences of such actions. The misconduct potentially undermined their own case.
It certainly is a sobering thought. So, for you, our listeners who are future lawyers, what are the key takeaways from Commonwealth v. Lewin? What are the crucial lessons you should be internalizing from this case as you embark on your legal careers?
Okay, there are several vital lessons here for you. Firstly, it really underscores the judiciary's reluctance, a strong reluctance to dismiss serious criminal charges solely as a sanction for police misconduct, unless there is a clear and demonstrable showing of prejudice to the defendant's fundamental right to a fair trial.
Prejudice is the key word there.
It really is in the majority view. The SJC's majority opinion clearly prioritizes the fairness of the trial itself. Secondly, the case vividly illustrates that persistent tension within the legal system, the tension between the need to deter even egregious police misconduct and the societal imperative to prosecute individuals accused of serious crime.
The balancing act.
Exactly. And the dissenting opinions offer a really powerful counterpoint, arguing for a stronger deterrent effect through dismissal in these egregious cases. Finally, Lewin exemplifies the principle that the remedies for governmental misconduct must strive to balance the protection of individual rights with the broader societal interest in the proper administration of justice. It's rarely a straightforward calculation. As you navigate your legal careers, you'll encounter this balancing act frequently.
So to bring this deep dive into Commonwealth v. Lewin to a close, we've examined a case where significant police misconduct, including lying to secure a search warrant and major issues surrounding a confidential informant, raise profound questions about due process and the fairness of a murder trial. While the lower court initially opted for dismissal, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ultimately reinstated the charges, emphasizing that dismissal remains an extraordinary remedy, really reserved for situations where a fair trial is genuinely no longer possible due to that misconduct.
And this leads us to a critical question for you all to consider as you continue your legal education. Given the undeniably serious nature, the deliberate nature, of the falsehoods presented by the police and Lewin, at what point should misconduct automatically trigger dismissal, even if definitively proving prejudice is challenging?
That's the tough question.
It is. Reflect on the potential long-term ramifications of tolerating such behavior on the public's confidence in law enforcement and really the foundational integrity of our judicial process. Is there a threshold beyond which the system itself is fundamentally compromised, requiring a more drastic response?
That's a powerful point to ponder. And for those of you interested in further exploration, this case definitely touches upon several related legal doctrines and issues that are well worth investigating further. Things like the exclusionary rule, you know, preventing illegally obtained evidence from being used in court, the complexities of prosecutorial misconduct, which is a whole other area, and the crucial role and effectiveness, or lack thereof sometimes, of internal affairs investigations within police departments.
Huh.
Consider how these interconnected elements shape our pursuit of justice. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.